is my resolution to the Fermi paradox. We are the first civilization to emerge in the Milky Way, and we are alone. That is my opinion. And given our cavalier disregard for our own safety, it terrifies me. What do you think? Chapter 3. Who are we?
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why 35 years ago fly the Atlantic? We choose to go to the moon.
President John F. Kennedy. Spaceman. Astronaut John Young was once asked how he would feel if his epitaph read, John Young, the Ultimate Explorer. Young smiled and, in a test pilot's drawl, replied, I'd feel sorry for the guy who wrote it. Young was, and still is, a hero of mine. My first vivid memory of live space exploration was watching Space Shuttle Columbia climb on a tower of bright vapour into a blue Cape sky on the 12th of April 1981. It was midday in Manchester, the Easter holidays, and I was 13 years old. Because of a two-day launch delay, Columbia's test flight took place precisely 20 years to the day after Yuri Gagarin made his black-and-white voyage into orbit on the 12th of April 1961. But Young and his co-pilot Bob Crippen, in their orange spacesuits, were astronauts from the colour age, the future, as distant from the Russian hero as gleaming white-winged Columbia was from Vostok 1. Equidistant from both was Apollo, which Young flew to the moon. Twice. It was the age of optimism, the age of wonder, the golden age when the ape went into space. When unflappable aviator Young, whose pulse rate did not increase during the launch of NASA's only manned spacecraft ever to have flown without an unmanned test flight, piloted Columbia back for a flawless manual landing at Edwards Air Force Base 2 days later, he turned to Crippen and said, We're not too far away. The human race isn't. From going to the stars. In 2014, the stars feel further away than they did in 1981. The International Space Station is a wonderful piece of engineering that has allowed us to learn how to live and work in near-Earth orbit, but it is no closer to the stars than Columbia. Its construction is no mean achievement. One of the most important things to realize about engineering at the edge is that the only way to learn is to actually do it. You can't think your way into space, you have to fly there. But I can't help but feel, in the words of Billy Bragg, that the space race is over and we've all grown up too soon. It was different in Gagarin's day. Nobody's born to be a spaceman. We're apes, honed by natural selection to operate in the Great Rift Valley. Gagarin's father was a carpenter, and his mother was a milkmaid. Both worked on a collective farm. Gagarin's first job at the age of 16 was in a steel mill. But after showing an aptitude for flight as an air cadet, he joined the military when 21 and was posted to the 1st Chkalovsk Air Force Pilot School in Orenburg. Rising through the ranks, he made a name for himself as a skilled and intelligent aviator, and in early 1960 he was chosen along with 19 other elite pilots for the newly established space program. Standing just 5'2" tall, Gagarin had the right stuff and was perfect for the tiny Vostok spacecraft, whose single-seat crew compartment was only 2.3 meters in external diameter. After a year of training, Nikolai Kamenin, head of the cosmonaut program, chose Gagarin ahead of his rival German Titov, just 4 days before the flight. The history books are filled with the names of great men and women whose presence in the collective memory of humanity was assured by the slimmest of margins. Gagarin, alongside Armstrong, will be remembered for as long as there are humans in the cosmos. The name of the equally brilliant Titov, Russian's second cosmonaut, has faded away. Gagarin's flight was a true journey into the unknown. Strapped on top of the Vostok K rocket, which flew 13 times and made it into space on 11 occasions, the 27-year-old performed like a true test pilot. Despite a 2-hour delay during which every component of the spacecraft hatch was taken apart and rebuilt while Gagarin remained strapped into his seat, his heart rate was recorded at 64 beats per minute just before launch. This is not to say that Gagarin wasn't fully aware of what he was about to do. Before boarding, Gagarin made one of the great speeches of the age. "Dear friends, both known and unknown to me, fellow Russians and people of all countries and continents, in a few minutes, a mighty spaceship will carry me into the faraway expanses of space. What can I say to you in these last minutes before the start? At this instant, the whole of my life seems to be condensed into one wonderful moment. Everything I have experienced and done till now has been in preparation for this moment. You must realize that it is hard to express my feeling now that the test for which we have been training long and passionately is at hand. I don't have to tell you what I felt when it was suggested that I should make this flight, the first in history. Was it joy? No, it was something more than that. Pride? No, it was not just pride. I felt great happiness. To be the first to enter the cosmos, to engage single-handed in an unprecedented duel with nature, could anyone dream of anything greater than that? But immediately after that, I thought of the tremendous responsibility I bore, to be the first to do what generations of people had dreamed of, to be the first to pave the way into space for mankind. This responsibility is not toward one person, not toward a few dozen, not toward a group. It is a responsibility toward all mankind, toward its present and its future. Am I happy as I set off on this space flight? Of course I'm happy. After all, in all times and epochs, the greatest happiness for man has been to take part in new discoveries. It is a matter of minutes now before the start. I say to you, until we meet again, dear friends, just as people say to each other when setting out on a long journey, I would like very much to embrace you all, people known and unknown to me, close friends and strangers alike. See you soon." It's too easy to attach trite labels to human actions, magnificent, horrific, and everything in between, based on a simplified view of their causes. One can argue that the rockets carried aloft the egos of the superpowers alongside the astronauts, and this is surely right. But Gagarin spoke these words, and I challenge anyone to read them and not detect sincerity. All our actions mask a morass of motivations, worthy and less so. And the greatest human adventures are no less noble for that. At 9:07 a.m. local time, Gagarin blasted off from Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan, as every Russian cosmonaut has done since. Within 10 minutes, he was orbiting Earth at an altitude of 380 kilometers. His route took him across the Siberian wastes and the Pacific Ocean above the Hawaiian Islands, past the tip of South America and into the South Atlantic, where he was greeted by a second sunrise before a 42-second de-orbit burn over the Angolan coast slowed Vostok 1 into a parabolic orbit and an 8G deceleration inside Earth's thickening atmosphere. The journey once around his home world took 1 hour and 48 minutes. Gagarin ejected from the capsule 7 kilometers above ground, and, as planned, cosmonaut and spacecraft completed the final descent apart. Gliding back to Earth by parachute, Gagarin landed 280 kilometers away from the intended landing site near the Russian city of Engels. Dressed in orange spacesuit and white helmet, a farmer and his daughter bore sole witness to his historic return. "When they saw me in my spacesuit and the parachute dragging alongside as I walked, they started to back away in fear," recollected Gagarin later. "I told them, 'Don't be afraid. I am a Soviet citizen like you, who has descended from space, and I must find a telephone to call Moscow.'" Ape Man. Primates appeared relatively recently in the history of life on Earth. Studies of mitochondrial DNA suggest the Strepsirrhini suborder, containing the ancestors of Madagascar's lemurs, diverged from our own Haplorrhini suborder approximately 64 million years ago, which implies that a common ancestor was present before this time, but not a great deal earlier. The first complete primate fossil found to date is that of a tree-dwelling creature known as Archicebus achilles, dated at 55 million years old. Discovered in the fossil beds of central China in 2013, this tiny creature would have been no bigger than a human hand, making it not only the oldest, but also one of the smallest known primates. Our family, known as the hominidae, or more commonly the great apes, share a common ancestor with old world monkeys around 25 million years ago. And during the making of Human Universe, we filmed a rare species of these distant cousins in the Ethiopian highlands. The road out of Addis towards the 3,000-metre Gwasa Plateau is excellent to a point, and then not excellent. The scenery, on the other hand, improves with altitude. Golden grass is illuminated by shifting lambent light through dark clouds, cling to near-vertical mountainsides framing pristine villages along the high valley floors. It is fresh, cold, and insectless on the peaks above the rift. A place to drink tea and eat shiro, a spiced Ethiopian stew of chickpeas and lentils. After a night in the cold but magnificently desolate Gwasa Community Lodge, we set off at dawn to intercept the Gelada baboons on their way back to their caves and ledges from early morning foraging expeditions on the higher slopes. The Gelada baboons are a species of old world monkey found only in the Ethiopian highlands. They're the only surviving species of the genus Therapithecus that once thrived across Africa and into southern Europe and India. The males in particular are powerful, long-haired animals, weighing over 20 kilograms, with a bright red flash of skin on their white chests. I was told not to look them in the eye, so I didn't. 50,000 years ago, as our planet emerged from the last ice age, the Gelada retreated into the highlands above the rift, where they still live, uniquely among extant primates, as graminivores, on a diet made up almost entirely of the tough, high-altitude grasses and occasional herbs. They approach with nonchalant agility in small groups, which reflect the most complex social structure of any non-human primate. Most of the groups I saw contained one or two males and perhaps 8 or 10 females and their young. These are referred to as reproductive units, and clearly defined hierarchies exist within them. Females usually remain in the same unit for life, but males move between them every 4 or 5 years. There are also male-only units of 10 or 15 individuals. These social units are arranged into higher groupings known as bands, herds, and communities. The community we encountered numbered several hundred individuals who wandered past in their little tribes, females and young pausing to eat, groom, and play, whilst the larger males eyed us closely. Despite the 25-million-year separation in evolutionary time, the Gelada are very easy to anthropomorphize, especially from a vantage point amongst them, probably because their behavior seems reminiscent of our own, and their babies are cute. Like us, they spend most of their time on the ground and operate in social groups. Some researchers familiar with the Geladas claim they exhibit the most sophisticated communication behavior of any non-human primate, employing gestures and a range of different vocalizations, strung together into sequences communicating reassurance, appeasement, solicitation, aggression, and defense. For all their sophistication, however, the Gelada are a long way from possessing anything more complex than the simplest of human characteristics and abilities. This is, of course, an utterly obvious observation. They are monkeys. But what isn't obvious is why. The Gelada separated from our common ancestor at the same time. But that self-evident statement leads to a deeper question. What is it that happened to our ancestors during those 25 million years that led us to the stars and left them on the hillsides of the Gwasa Plateau eating grass? Lucy in the Sky. I am an aviation geek. I love aircraft. As I set off to film the African scenes for Ape Man Spaceman, I noticed that the Ethiopian Airlines Boeing 787 I boarded at London Heathrow, bound for Addis Ababa, registration ETAOS, was named Lucy. On the morning of the 24th of November 1974, Donald Johansson and a team of archaeologists were searching for bone fragments at a site near the Awash River in Ethiopia. The area was known to be a site rich in rare hominid fossils, but on that particular morning, Johansson and his graduate student Tom Gray found little to inspire them. As is often the way in science, however, a dash of serendipity coupled with an experienced scientist who understands how to increase the chances of receiving its benefits made a seminal contribution to the understanding of human evolution. Johansson shouldn't even have been there. He had planned to spend time back at the camp updating his field notes. But as they prepared to leave, Johansson decided to wander over to a previously excavated gully and have one last look. Even though they'd surveyed the area before, this time Johansson's eye was drawn to something lying partially hidden on the slope. Closer inspection revealed it to be an arm bone, and a host of other skeletal fragments, a piece of skull, a thigh bone, vertebra, ribs, and jaw, all emerged from the ground, and crucially, they were all part of a single female skeleton. The find triggered a 3-week excavation, during which every last scrap of fossil AL288-1 was recovered. They named it Lucy, after track 3, side 1 of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, because this was 1974 and they played it a lot on their tape recorder. Home taping kills music, they used to say back then, but it also names airliners. Lucy lived 3.2 million years ago in the open savanna of Ethiopia's Afar Depression. Standing just over 1 meter tall and weighing less than 30 kilograms, she would have looked more ape-like than a human. Her brain was small, about one-third of the size of a modern human's and not much larger than a chimpanzee's. The anatomy of her knee, the curve of her spine and the length of her leg bones suggest that Lucy regularly walked upright on two legs, although there are a handful of scientists who would disagree. What is generally agreed upon, however, is that Lucy was a member of the extinct hominin species Australopithecus afarensis, and she was either one of our direct ancestors or very closely related to them. Her bipedalism was probably an evolutionary adaptation caused by climate change in the rift. As the number of trees reduced and the landscape became more savanna-like, the arboreal existence of our more distant ancestors became less favoured, and the increasing distances between trees selected for Australopithecus's upright gait made travel across the ground more efficient. In Who Speaks for Earth, the 13th chapter of Carl Sagan's Cosmos, there are two pictures set side by side. One is of footprints covered by volcanic ash 3.7 million years ago near Laetoli in Tanzania, probably made by an Australopithecus afarensis like Lucy. Some 400,000 kilometers away, and 3.7 million years later, another hominin footprint was left in the dust of the Sea of Tranquility. Together, they speak eloquently of our unlikely, magnificent ascent from the Rift Valley to the stars. The remainder of this chapter deals with the 3 million years between Lucy and the Moon. The timescale is ridiculously small, less than a tenth of 1% of the period of time during which life has existed on Earth. Lucy was little more than an upright chimpanzee, an animal, a genetic survival machine. We bring art, science, literature, and meaning to the earth. We are a world away, and yet separated by the blink of an eye. Our obligation to survive is owed not just to ourselves, but also to that cosmos, ancient and vast, from which we spring, wrote Sagan. I'd like to add that we owe it to Lucy as well. From the North Star to the Stars. Before astrology was consigned to the status of trifling funfair entertainment by science, it was believed that the position of the planets against the distant stars had a profound effect on people's daily lives. If you don't know what the stars or planets actually are, this is at least within the bounds of reason. But as our understanding of physics improved, so it became clear that there's no way that the position of a distant planet relative to the fixed stars can have any effect on the behaviour of a human being on the surface of the Earth. The planets can and do affect the Earth's motion through the solar system, over timescales far greater than those of human lifetimes, though. And recent research suggests that long-term changes in Earth's orientation and orbit may have played a crucial role in hominid evolution. Polaris is a true giant, almost 50 times the diameter of our sun. It is also a Cepheid variable, one of the valuable standard candles upon which the astronomical distance scale rests. At a distance of only 434 light-years, it's both the closest Cepheid and one of the brighter stars in the sky, dominating the constellation Ursa Minor. Polaris also happens to be aligned directly with the Earth's spin axis, and this special position on the celestial North Pole makes it invaluable to navigators. As the Earth spins on its axis, Polaris sits serenely as all other stars rotate around it. At any point in the Northern Hemisphere, your latitude is the angle between Polaris and the horizon, 0 degrees north at the equator, where Polaris is on the horizon, and 90 degrees north at the pole, where Polaris is directly overhead. As viewed from Oldham, Lancashire, UK, Polaris sits at an angle of 53.54 degrees above the horizon. Christopher Columbus and Ferdinand Magellan relied on Polaris as they crossed the oceans and explored new worlds. Perhaps more surprisingly, on board Apollo 8, Jim Lovell carried a sextant as a backup navigational device. Designed by the MIT Instrument Laboratory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, it may not have looked traditional, but it operated in exactly the same manner as the one constructed by instrument maker John Bird in 1757. Polaris was one of Apollo's key navigational stars. It was paired with Gamma Cassiopeiae on Lovell's charts, which was known in Apollo jargon as Navi. The name was coined by Gus Grissom on Apollo 1 as a prank. It was his middle name, Ivan, backwards. Two other navigational stars, Gamma Velorum and Iota Ursa Major, were named Rhagor after Roger Chaffee and Deneuques after Ed White II. Using the stars for navigation might seem hopelessly old-fashioned, but if you think about it for a moment, you'll realize that there's no other way that a spacecraft in deep space can orient itself, other than relative to the fixed stars on the celestial sphere. A spacecraft will often shift its position relative to the stars, but on Earth, things feel different because our orbit around the Sun is relatively stable from year to year. There are wobbles on relatively short timescales associated with changes in the speed of Earth's rotation, and these lead to the insertion of leap seconds to keep our atomic clocks synchronized with the heavens. Between 1972 and 1979, 9 leap seconds had to be inserted, whilst none was needed between the beginning of 1999 and the end of 2005. Earth's rotation rate is noticeably chaotic when compared to the accuracy of atomic clocks. The largest short-term contribution to changes in Earth's rotation comes from the gravitational influence of the Moon, which acts to slow down the rate of spin by around 2.3 milliseconds per century due to friction between the tidal bulges in the oceans and the rotating solid Earth beneath. But there are also longer-term changes. The most pronounced of these is known as axial precession, or more commonly, the precession of the equinoxes. The Earth spins on its axis like a gyroscope, and because it spins, it bulges out at the equator. Because the Earth isn't a perfect sphere, the gravitational influence of the Sun and Moon exerts a torque on the Earth that causes its spin axis to sweep round in a circle once every 26,000 years. This is not subtle, because the spin axis itself is tilted at 23 degrees relative to the plane of Earth's orbit, and precession therefore has a large effect on the night sky that was first documented by the Greek astronomer Hipparchus around 150 BCE. Precession manifests itself as a shift in the position of the celestial pole relative to the fixed stars. There will come a time in the not-too-distant future when Polaris will no longer sit above the celestial North Pole, as our spin axis traces out a circle in the sky. In about 3,000 years' time, Navigators of the future will rely on Gamma Cephei as a backup for their GPS systems as they sail across the seas of our planet, and in 8,000 years it will be the bright star Deneb. The identity of the North Star has altered many times throughout human history. As the Egyptians finished building the Great Pyramid of Giza in 2560 BCE, Alpha Draconis lay closest to the celestial pole. 2,500 years later, as the Romans did things for us, Kokarb, the second brightest star in Ursa Minor, and its neighbour Ferkard were known as the guardians of the pole. Precession, therefore, affects navigation. But more importantly, it also affects our climate. The 23-degree tilt of Earth's spin axis is responsible for the seasons. Summer in the Northern Hemisphere occurs when the North Pole is tilted towards the sun, leading to constant daylight within the Arctic Circle. Half a year later, and the geometry is reversed, with the South Pole receiving 24-hour daylight and the Southern Hemisphere experiencing summer. Precession alone would have no effect on the climate if the Earth's orbit were a perfect circle. But it isn't. It's elliptical, with the sun at one focus. At the turn of the 21st century, it happens to be the case that the Earth is at its closest approach to the sun, known as perihelion, in January, just after the winter solstice, when the North Pole is pointing away from the sun. This makes northern winters slightly milder than they would otherwise be, because the Earth receives a little bit more solar radiation during the northern winter. In around 10,000 years' time, however, precession will have carried the Earth's spin axis around by a half turn, and it will be the North Pole that points towards the sun at perihelion, making northern hemisphere summers slightly warmer and winters cooler. The more elliptical the Earth's orbit, the more pronounced this effect. This is where things get a little more complicated, but it's the complication that matters for our story. The planets are significantly further away than the moon, but also significantly more massive, and their constantly shifting positions induce periodic changes to our orbit over long timescales. Jupiter has the most pronounced effect due to its large mass and relative proximity. The largest of these changes occurs on a timescale of 400,000 years. Picture the Earth's orbit becoming periodically more elliptical and more circular, stretching back and forth with a period of 400,000 years. This oscillation modulates the effect of precession on the climate. At the times when the Earth's orbit is at its most elliptical, the changes due to precession will be at their most pronounced. This effect is known as astronomical or orbital forcing of the climate. There are many such resonances in Earth's orbit. Another important change in the eccentricity of the ellipse occurs every 100,000 years. Furthermore, the tilt of the axis itself swings back and forth between around 22 and 25 degrees on a 41,000-year cycle. The whole solar system is like a giant bell, ringing with many hundreds of harmonics, driven by the gravitational interactions between the sun, planets, and moons. Over many thousands of years, these shifts in the Earth's orbit and orientation relative to the sun have led to dramatic changes in climate and are certainly one of the key mechanisms that drive the Earth into and out of ice ages. It is perhaps obvious that these long-term shifts in climate should have had an effect on the evolution of life. Ice ages present a significant challenge to animals and plants, and this will provoke an evolutionary response via natural selection. More surprisingly, recent research has suggested a direct link between precession, the 400,000-year eccentricity cycle, and the evolution of early modern humans. Climate change in the Rift Valley and human evolution. The Great Rift Valley. Evocative words that immediately suggest origins. There are many reasons I love visiting Ethiopia. I love the people. I love the food. I love the high-altitude freshness of Addis. I love the mountains and valleys and high plains. I even loved visiting Erta Ale, the legendary shield volcano at the Afar Triple Junction known as the Gateway to Hell, although I probably won't do it again. But I also love an idea. It's impossible to visit this ancient country and not catch a glimpse in your peripheral vision of a chain of ghosts stretching back 10,000 generations, because it is firmly embedded in popular culture that we came from here. Every one of us is related to someone who lived in Ethiopia hundreds of thousands of years ago. It is the Garden of Eden, the place where humanity began. What popular culture has yet to assimilate, however, is the fortuitous and precarious nature of the ascent of man. When I was growing up, I remember talk of the missing link, that elusive fossil that would tie us definitively to our ape-like ancestors. When I started school, DNA sequencing was not yet invented, and Lucy hadn't been unearthed. Today, we have a significantly more complete view of how Australopithecines like Lucy are related to modern humans, and whilst the details are still debated and new evidence is continually updating the standard model of hominin evolution, it's now possible to tell the broad sweep of the story in some detail. The members of our human evolutionary family are referred to as hominins. The split between hominins and the ancestor of the chimpanzee occurred at some point before 5 million years ago in Africa, and by 4 million years ago, Australopithecus afarensis, Lucy, was present. Their brain size was approximately 500 cc, around the same as a chimpanzee, and less than one-third that of a modern human. Around 1.8 million years ago, there was a step change in both brain size and the number of hominin species in the East African Rift. Several species of our genus Homo appeared, including Homo habilis and Homo erectus. They lived for a time alongside other species, including several Australopithecines and a genus known as Paranthropus. There are anthropologists who prefer to classify Paranthropus as a different species of Australopithecus. I make this point not to be confusing, but to highlight an important fact. The study of hominin evolution is a difficult area, and it's not surprising that there are ongoing debates about the classification of 2 million-year-old fossils and DNA sequences. What's important for our story, however, and what nobody disputes, is that there seems to have been a jump in both brain size and the number of species of hominins in the Rift Valley region around 1.8 million years ago. By around 1.4 million years ago, only one of these species had survived, Homo erectus, with a brain size of 1,000 cc. The next milestone is the appearance of Homo heidelbergensis around 800,000 years ago. Homo heidelbergensis is generally accepted to be the ancestor of Homo sapiens and the Neanderthals who lived alongside us in Europe until around 45,000 years ago and possibly later. Homo heidelbergensis represented another jump in brain size, up to around 1400 cc, which is close to that of modern humans. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, two hominin skulls were found near the Omo River in Ethiopia. Known as Omo 1 and Omo 2, argon dating of the volcanic sediments around the level they were found dates them at 195,000 plus or minus 5,000 years old. These are the earliest fossilized remains to have been identified as Homo sapiens. The interesting question is what caused these rapid increases in brain size, driving hominin intelligence from the chimpanzee-like capabilities of Australopithecus to modern humans in only a few million years. Again, this is a very active area of research, and there are differences of opinion amongst experts. This is the nature of science at the frontier of knowledge, and this is what makes science exciting and successful. The model we are focusing on is the most widely accepted theory of human evolution. It is known as the recent single origin hypothesis, or more colloquially, the out of Africa model. And the dates and locations we've described so far might be referred to as textbook. There is broad consensus, therefore, about the when and the where, but not why. And it is to why that we now turn. There's a trend towards larger brain size over the 4 million years since the emergence of Australopithecus, but the trend is not gradual. There's a large jump around 1.8 million years ago with the emergence of Homo erectus, and another jump just under 1 million years ago with Homo heidelbergensis. The final jump occurs when Homo sapiens emerges 200,000 years ago. The time period around 1.8 million years ago also corresponds to a leap in the number of hominin species present in the Rift Valley. There were at least 5 or 6 species living side by side, suggesting that something interesting occurred around this time, which may have been responsible for, or was a contributing factor to, the observed increase in brain size, particularly in Homo erectus. The large number of deep water lakes appearing temporarily in the Rift Valley around 1.8 million years ago indicates that at this time the climate, and in particular the level of rainfall, was varying quickly and violently. Similar climate variation occurs around 1 million years ago and 200,000 years ago, and this appears to be correlated with increase in hominin brain size. The theory is that rapidly changing climatic conditions in the Rift Valley at these specific times played an important role in driving the increases in brain size. The selection pressures that may have led to these increases are unclear. Selection for adaptability was probably an important factor, but social factors such as the ability to live in large groups and intraspecies competition as a result of the larger number of species living side by side, particularly around 1.8 million years ago, must also have played a role. Having said that, it does appear that climate variation in the Rift Valley 1.8 million, 1 million and 200,000 years ago could have been a contributing factor to the development of our intelligence. This is known as the pulse climate variability hypothesis. We can now bring all these threads together to reveal a surprising and, for me, dizzying hypothesis, which, if correct, sheds new light on the immensely contingent nature of the existence of our modern civilization, or, in simpler language, why we are bloody lucky to be here. The three dates, 1.8 million, 1 million and 200,000 years ago, correspond to the times when the Earth's orbit was at its most elliptical. As described earlier, the mechanism by which climate changes due to precession at these times is well understood. The pulse climate variability hypothesis asserts that the unique geology and position of the Great Rift Valley amplified these changes, and that early hominins responded by increasing their brain size. If this is correct, our brains evolved as a response to changes in the Earth's orbit, driven by the precise arrangement of the orbits of the other planets around the Sun, and precession, driven primarily by the gravitational interaction between the Moon and Earth's axial tilt, both of which date back to a collision early in the history of the solar system. And all this is plainly blind luck. Without an inconceivably unlikely set of coincidences, and the way these conspired together to change the climate in one system of valleys in wonderful Ethiopia, we wouldn't exist. If this is correct, then what a response. I held a brain for the cameras at St. Paul's Teaching Hospital in Addis. It is the most complex single object in the known universe, a most intricate example of emergent complexity, assembled over 4 billion years by natural selection, operating within the constraints placed upon it by the laws of physics and the particular biochemistry of life on Earth. The brain contains around 85 billion individual neurons, which is of the same order as the number of stars in an average galaxy. But that doesn't begin to describe its complexity. Each neuron is thought to make between 10,000 and 100,000 connections to other neurons, making the brain a computer way beyond anything our current technology can simulate. When we do manage to simulate one, I have no doubt that sentience will emerge. Consciousness is not magic. It is an emergent property consistent with the known laws of nature. But that doesn't lessen the wonder one iota. Out of this evolutionary marvel, we emerge. Thoughts, feelings, hopes, and dreams exist on Earth because of electrical activity inside a 1.5 kilogram blob of stuff, which hasn't changed much since the earliest modern humans began the long journey out of Africa. If you could travel back in time and bring a newborn baby from 200,000 years ago into the 21st century, allowing it to grow up in our modern society with a modern education, it could achieve anything a modern child could. It could even become an astronaut. Which sets up one more question. If the hardware was present 200,000 years ago, then what changed to lift us from the Great Rift Valley into space? An unprecedented duel with nature. "The best thing we can do now is just to listen and hope," said Cliff Mitchellmore, broadcasting from the BBC studios 24 minutes from the expected splashdown of Apollo 13. On the 17th of April 1970, I was too young to watch the live broadcast, but I've seen the recording many times since. Grainy pictures from the deck of the USS Iwo Jima, its flight deck crammed with nervous sailors off the coast of Samoa. Patrick Moore and Jeffrey Pardo, grim-faced in the studios, and James Burke, famously with fingers crossed behind his back.
Apollo Control, Houston, we've just had loss of signal from Honeysuckle.
Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station in Canberra, Australia, was the last ground station to contact Apollo 13 before it entered the Earth's atmosphere on its way home. Signal loss during re-entry is routine high drama on all space missions. The ionization of the atmosphere caused by the frictional heating of the spacecraft blocks radio signals, typically resulting in radio silence for 4 minutes. On Apollo 13, 6 minutes passed in silence. The brilliance of the BBC's quartet of commentators was in the silence they allowed on the airwaves. The only sound was the static of the NASA feed, a moment of genuine tension. No need for vacuous media babble. Nobody could bring themselves to speak. We'll only know whether that heat shield was damaged by that explosion 3 days ago, when they come out of radio blackout in just over 2 minutes, said Burke. Silence. As 4 minutes passed, Houston reports, 10 seconds to end of radio blackout. Silence. Houston. We've had a report that Orion 4 aircraft has acquisition of signal. They're through, says Burke. Let's not anticipate because the parachutes may have been damaged. Chutes should be out, murmurs Burke. Not broadcasting, just saying. There they are. There they are. They've made it, remarks Moore. And then applause. I make it no more than 5 seconds late, shouts Burke. No more than 5 seconds late. The safe return of Apollo 13 was arguably NASA's finest hour. 55 hours, 54 minutes, and 53 seconds into the mission, 320,000 kilometers from Earth, Lunar Module pilot Jack Swigert switched on a system of stirring fans in the hydrogen and oxygen tanks in the service module, a routine procedure. A piece of Teflon insulation inside the tank had been damaged, it was later discovered, by a series of unlikely events that happened on the ground during the preparation of the spacecraft for flight. The wire shorted, the tank exploded, and the side of the service module was blown off, critically damaging the spacecraft's power supply systems and venting the crew's oxygen supply out into space. The command module, the only part of the spacecraft capable of surviving a re-entry through the Earth's atmosphere, was now running on batteries, and with a rapidly diminishing oxygen supply that would not keep the astronauts alive long enough to return to Earth. The only option was to shut down the command module and retreat to the lunar module, effectively using it as a life raft. Lovell later spoke of how he didn't regret the mission at all. He was robbed of his moon landing, which must have been doubly frustrating given he'd already flown to the moon on the historic Apollo 8 mission. But his reaction, revealed in interviews in later life, offers great insight into the character of a test pilot. We were given the situation, Lovell explained, to really exercise our skills and our talents to take a situation which was almost certainly catastrophic and come home safely. That's why I thought that 13 of all the flights, including Apollo 11, that 13 exemplified a real test pilot's flight. Both Lovell and Hayes have said that the idea of not returning safely to Earth never really came up. There was nothing there that said irrefutably, we don't have a chance. Hayes was correct, of course, because they did return safely. But they only had enough food and water to sustain 2 people for a day and a half, and had to improvise a carbon dioxide filter to provide them with enough breathable air for the return journey. Locked in the lunar module with limited supplies of food and water, and temperatures dropping towards freezing, life was far from comfortable. With the command module powered down to preserve the sparse battery supplies left after the loss of the fuel cells, the crew had to survive in a hostile environment with limited resources. Like so many outposts of human civilization throughout history, shortage of water was a primary concern. Water was critical on the lunar module for 2 reasons, as well as being needed to keep the crew hydrated and to rehydrate the food, It also cooled the electrical systems on the spacecraft. Conserving water therefore became a critical part of the plan to return to Earth. Reducing their intake to just 1/5 of a normal human water ration, each of the crew suffered severe dehydration, and together they lost 31.5 pounds in weight, nearly 50% more than any other Apollo crew. Despite the discomfort, setting a new mission trajectory and navigating their way along it remained the primary challenge. The standard way to make in-flight course corrections on Apollo was to use the command module's main engine, but the system was located close to the damaged site and mission controllers decided that lighting it was too great a risk. Instead, the decision was made to use the LM's descent engine to send them around the far side of the moon and back to Earth in 4.5 days. This is known as a free return trajectory, a slingshot around the moon at the correct angle to return directly to Earth. No one knew if an engine designed for a completely different purpose would perform this function successfully, but they knew that if it failed, they would not return. 5 hours after the initial explosion, the LM engine was fired for a 35-second burn, successfully putting the crew onto a free return trajectory. This solved one problem, but raised another. Calculations of the trajectory estimated return to Earth 153 hours after launch, which would push the key reserves on the craft too low for comfort. So it was decided to speed up the spacecraft with another burn, cutting the total time of the voyage by 10 crucial hours. Such were the slim margins on Apollo 13. The main navigation system in the command module was out of action, so Lovell had to calculate the correct navigational inputs, while back at base, mission control worked through the same calculations as a cross-check. Lovell also got to use his sextant, which he played with on Apollo 8, to navigate by the stars for real. The calculations are preserved as handwritten notes in the Lunar Module System's activation checklist. This was the checklist Lovell and Hayes would have used to fly down to the moon's surface. Now useless, Lovell used the waste paper to write down instructions to put the ship on course for Earth. 2 hours after they rounded the far side of the moon, the LM engine fired, following Lovell's handwritten checklist, increasing the speed of the spacecraft by 860 feet per second and buying them 10 precious hours. The most dramatic rescue in the history of human spaceflight stands as a testament to the brilliance of the three test pilots, Lovell, Hayes, and Swigert, and also to the brilliance of the engineers on the ground, who simply knew their stuff. NASA's Apollo engineers were young by today's standards. The average age of the team in mission control for the splashdown of Apollo 11 was 28 years old. This is one of the reasons why the United States reaped such a colossal economic reward from its investment in Apollo. The generation of scientists and engineers who worked on and were inspired by Apollo went out into the wider economy and delivered a huge investment return. A series of studies, including one by Chase Econometrics, showed that for every dollar invested in Apollo, at least $6 or $7 was returned as increased GDP growth. This should, of course, be bloody obvious. New knowledge grows GDP. But every generation of politicians seems to require re-educating to understand the difference between spending and investment. And while I'm polemicizing, let me say that the usual political argument that public support is needed for such large investments is drivel. Firstly, the investment in NASA wasn't that large, never exceeding 4.5% of the federal budget throughout the lifetime of Apollo. And secondly, it is a politician's job to lead from the front. Make the case that investment in knowledge, in pushing the boundaries of human capabilities and exploring all frontiers, both physical and intellectual, is the key to the future wealth, prosperity, and security of civilization. Aspire to be Kennedy, not a hand-wringing apologist for intellectual and technological decline. The 9 Apollo flights to the moon remain the furthest modern humans have explored beyond the Rift Valley in our 200,000-year history. Homo sapiens first left Africa in large numbers 60,000 years ago. So on geological timescales, we didn't hang around. Our ancestors followed waves of earlier hominins.
Homo erectus were in Southeast Asia 1.6 million years ago, and half a million years later Neanderthals had colonized Europe, and Homo floresiensis were in Southern Asia. The details of the migration 60,000 years ago are particularly well understood as a result of the combination of genetic, archaeological, and linguistic studies. The precision comes in part from the tracking sequences of mitochondrial DNA, which is passed down from the mother and not shuffled by sex. This makes it relatively stable and easy to track. Changes are caused by mutations alone. The most widely accepted interpretation of the data suggests that a small population of between 1,000 and 2,500 individuals left East Africa 60,000 years ago and moved north across the Red Sea and through Arabia. The group then split, moving into southern Europe 43,000 years ago and travelling through India and into Australia on roughly the same timescale. The crossing into North America via eastern Russia was probably later, around 15,000 years ago. These early groups of humans were hunter-gatherers. It's been estimated that the basic social units would have reached a maximum of around 150 individuals. This is known as Dunbar's number, after the British anthropologist Robin Dunbar, who suggests that the largest social group amongst any given population of primates is related to the size of their brains, specifically the neocortex. Dunbar's number can be observed today in the size of the average person's social network, both in the real world and online. Our hardware, the brain, has not changed appreciably since the first humans appeared in Africa 200,000 years ago. These social groups would have lived in loosely bound tribes, perhaps reaching a size of between 1 and 2,000 individuals, operating within an area of around 100 kilometres. Populations would stabilise, perhaps in response to social factors, but also as a result of increased mortality rates caused by parasitic diseases and diminishing per capita resource availability, before fragmenting and spreading. In this fashion, the rate of progression of our ancestors across the globe has been estimated to have been around 0.5 kilometres per year, or 15 kilometres per generation. Population density did not rise significantly beyond these levels until these proto-societies shifted from a hunter-gatherer lifestyle to agriculture around 12,000 years ago. This shift was the trigger for the development of civilization. The most important single step following the migration out of Africa in the journey from ape-man to spaceman. Farming, the bedrock of civilization. There are many competing theories as to the reason for the domestication of crops, but many note the correlation between the first evidence of agriculture and the beginning of the current interglacial period known as the Holocene, 12,000 years ago. In the Fertile Crescent around modern-day Jordan and Syria, people known as the Natufians were beginning to settle into larger communities, perhaps because of the relatively benign climate. The area would have been forested and rich in wild cereals, fruits and nuts, rather than the austere desert of today. One theory is that a brief 1,000-year cold period known as the Younger Dryas, beginning around 10,800 BCE, triggered drier conditions in the region, forcing the Natufians to begin cultivating the previously abundant wild crops on which they had come to rely. Whatever the reason, it's generally agreed that the foundational crops of modern agriculture, including wheat, barley, peas and lentils, were all to be found in the Fertile Crescent by 9,000 BCE, and by 8,000 BCE, the banks of the Nile were being cultivated. At approximately the same time, evidence of farming can be found in Asia's Indus Valley, in China, and in Mesoamerica. This suggests that there was no single environmental or developmental cause for agriculture, because it appeared independently at many sites across the world. Rather, our large brains and relatively large social groups were ready to take up the challenge when the need arose. Once agriculture was established, larger numbers of people could live together, taking advantage of the more stable food supply. The freedom from continual hunting and gathering would have introduced a new aspect to human life, free time, and it was used to great effect.
Some of the earliest farmers settled in a place known as Beda in modern-day Jordan around 7000 BCE. Living in round stone-built houses, they grew barley and wheat and kept domesticated goats, engaged in ritual and ceremony, and buried their dead. Importantly, each of these activities was carried out in specific areas of the settlements, the beginning of town planning. By the 2nd century BCE, a Semitic people known as the Nabataeans lived around Beda. They employed new technologies to increase the reliability of farming and constructed walled agricultural terraces on the hillsides around the village to collect and store water. Animal husbandry was also expanding, with the domestication of cows, pigs, donkeys, and horses. Even previously dangerous animals were coerced into living with humans. There is evidence that the Nabataeans kept dogs. As the great empires of Egypt, Greece, and Rome prospered, the Nabataeans remained partially nomadic, driving their camel trains across the desert along the long-established trade routes between North Africa and India, and the great